From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Ron Reagan Jr. He stars in a new comedy special that pokes fun at his image as the celebrity who's gotten where he is because he's the president's son. Also today, I talk with jazz composer and saxophonist Edward Wilkerson. He leads the 25-piece big band Shadow Vignettes, as well as the octet Eight Bold Souls, which has just released a new album. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from Eddie Hinton. It's called Letters from Mississippi, and it's a mix of rock, soul, and rhythm and blues. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the box office hit Three Men and a Baby. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Ron Reagan Jr. is following in his father's footsteps, not taking the political path his father eventually took, but instead heading in the direction of the president's first career, show business. Ron Reagan Jr. is starring in a new Cinemax comedy special. It's called Ron Reagan is the President's Son. Reagan plays himself as a TV journalist on a morning talk show. He's having problems with his co-workers, who insist on calling him the President's Son instead of Ron. In the opening scene, he goes in to discuss this with the show's producer, accompanied by his ever-present crew of Secret Service men.
That's it. I'm sick of it. Happened again, Diane. They won't call me by my real name. They're making fun of me.
Well, you are who you are. And, well, frankly, everyone is still a little steamed about that weekly strip search thing.
Standard operating procedure, ma'am. If you don't like it, hire a journalist.
Come on, guys. I am a journalist.
You do a fine job, Ron. And I'm sure you'd still have this job even if your father was only Senate Majority Leader.
How did you get the HBO special? How did the idea come up?
Well, HBO just called me up and said they wanted to offer me this Cinemax comedy experiment. And I said, sure, why not? Sounds fun. And worked on a script for a while, and it really wasn't going anywhere. Nobody was happy with it. And then Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller called up, and he said, listen, Ron, I've got an idea. You may not like it, but here it is. He said, I know you don't like to do things that sort of explicitly make mention of your connection to your parents and all that sort of thing. But what if we go way over the top with it? What if we really take it all the way and have a lot of fun with it? I said, yeah, great, no problem. So he and Eddie Gorodetsky wrote a script, and it was terrific, and we did it.
Did the writers of the HBO special interview you about what seemed most absurd to you about being a president's son?
Well, I'd known Penn and Teller, and actually had known Eddie Gorodetsky for a little while too. So they were sort of aware of what was bizarre about being the president's son. So there wasn't much rewriting or anything. They went off, did a script, came back, we read it. It was great, and there were only minor changes made.
Well, I thought I could mention some of the absurd aspects of it from the program and see what it's like in real life. In the special, you get the idea that, you know, if you as the president's son are modest, then people assume that it's just false modesty. But if you're comfortable with power, then it's assumed that you can sic the government on them if you want to.
Yeah, that's true. I guess a lot of people probably do assume that I could, like, have them audited as Ron, the character Ron does in the special.
Has that actually come up, though, where people have really thought that you are going to do something to them like that in an act of revenge?
I don't know if people have been afraid of that, possibly. You know, I of course, that's not really reality. I've probably not called in more than a half a dozen airstrikes in the time that my father's been president.
Then there's also the Secret Service question, which in the program, the Secret Service is always interfering with your personal life.
Interfering with your personal life and giving you no respect whatsoever. That was my favorite part in the special, is that the Secret Service men really can't stand Ron, and they don't have any respect for him whatsoever.
Is that how you feel now?
Well, no. I mean, you know, of course everything was exaggerated there, and most of the Secret Service people are pretty nice guys. But it is a little strange being followed everywhere you go. I was glad that I was married when my father became president, because dating with Secret Service must be really hell.
There's some terrific journalism jokes in this special. And I have to tell you that when you became a guest anchor at Good Morning America for a few days. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah. Labor Day, actually. It was only
one day
that I hosted it. They wised up after that.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. I was kind of really outraged, thinking, gosh, whatever happened to the notion of conflict of interest? Because I know that it's an entertainment show, but it's also, you know, a political magazine. What went through your mind when you decided to accept that offer?
Actually, the first thing that went through my mind is that I was going to have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, which didn't thrill me at all. There is a certain conflict of interest, or there could be anyway. I don't think there was on that particular show. And I'm not really comfortable calling myself a journalist. That's not the way I think of myself, and it's not the way I think of what I do, even on Good Morning America. I mean, I'm sort of an entertainer of some kind or another, and that's the sort of pieces I usually do.
Well, you interview a lot of celebrities now on television.
Yeah, you do that, and you know, sort of color pieces that you do, and you try and have fun with them. You try and make it fun for the audience, you know, whether it's diving out of an airplane or, you know, whatever you happen to be doing.
Well, you've certainly been interviewed a lot in your life. Have you learned the things that you do or don't want to do as an interviewer? Have you learned a lot of lessons from being the subject of a lot of articles and portraits?
Yeah, I suppose so. I'm rather uncomfortable going after people's personal lives, especially when they're just, you know, if it's an actor or something like that. It's really none of anybody's business. I don't feel it's anybody's business what I do in my personal life, and I get uncomfortable if I have an editor or a producer who's pushing me to do that with somebody else. It's one thing if you've got a presidential candidate sitting in front of you and you want to know a little bit more about their character. There's that big word for this season. But with somebody who's in the entertainment field, who cares, really?
Are there questions that you swore you would never ask anybody?
Questions? Yeah. What if you were a tree, something like that?
That's right.
Which one it would be? Yeah, yeah. I guess so.
You must get.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, or you know, who did you sleep with last night? That's another no-no.
You must get a lot of wacky offers now from people who want to use you on commercials or in programs.
Yeah, somebody not too long ago, the people who are in charge of Morris the Cat, whatever cat food that he represents, they wanted me to endorse him as a presidential candidate, fly to Washington, big press conference, all that sort of thing. Didn't think that would be such a good idea.
So is this HBO special a new turn in direction for you, or do you want to be doing more acting now?
I'd like to give it a try. I mean, I don't know if I'll really be very good at it. I think I could be. But you never really know how you're going to be received by an audience or by the people who are in charge of putting those things together. But I give it a shot, see what it's like. I like the process. I enjoy the process. It takes a little pressure off you when you don't have to be yourself anymore.
Did your father give you any advice on acting?
Well, his is sort of the old school of acting about, you know, learn the lines, don't bump into the furniture. So that's about the only advice I've gotten so far.
Ron Reagan is my guest, and he has a Cinemax comedy experiment that debuts on cable TV on January 15th. You know, I think when people are teenagers, especially people of a younger generation, when they're teenagers, they frequently want to rebel against their parents, have a really different kind of lifestyle than their parents did. And when you came of age, your father was a well-known political figure. He was governor and then, of course, president.
Yeah.
Did you have fantasies of the bohemian life when you were coming of age?
Well, when I was coming of age, bohemian it probably isn't the right word for it. I lived a sort of a counterculture kind of life, I suppose, as much as any, you know, 17-year-old or whatever could. Was thrown out of high school and, you know, did my share of substance abusing and that sort of thing, as most people did then. And, I wasn't real popular with, like, school administrations and stuff.
What did you get thrown out of high school for?
What did I get thrown out of high school for? As I recall, it was sort of a technicality. It was something about, like, I was at a boarding school, and I sort of didn't sign out properly to leave the campus. But what it really came down to was they just wanted to get rid of me. I was too much trouble.
What kinds of things did you do that caused the trouble?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it was the sort of things that everybody was doing in those days. I mean, it was kind of early 70s still, I guess. They just sort of knew I was into things that weren't real popular with school administrators and teachers and stuff, but they could never catch me, which really infuriated me. It really infuriated them. So they uh, they just got me on a technicality. There I went.
So when you dropped out of high school, did you... I'm sorry, when you got thrown out of that high school, did you go to another high school afterwards?
Yeah, yeah. It was like halfway through my junior year in high school, and they gave me the boot.
So you went to another one?
I went to another one, finished high school, yeah, and actually did a semester of college, too.
And then you dropped out of college?
Then I left college and started dancing, yeah.
Did you drop out because you wanted to dance?
Yeah, Yeah. I was never really crazy about school anyway. I have nothing against higher education. I think that's it's a wonderful thing, but it just didn't seem to be for me at the time anyway.
You were 18 when you started to dance. What interested you then in the art?
I was fascinated by the way dancers moved. The whole the plasticity and the, you know, the elevation of a Baryshnikov and things like that. And I had been actually since I was young, but when you're a kid growing up in America, you sort of think of ballet dancers as people that are hatched out of pods somewhere on the, you know, the Siberian tundra. So it never occurred to me that you could actually become one of these people until I was older.
And what made you think that you could become one?
Well, I didn't know I could become one. I was well aware of the fact that I was starting almost ridiculously late. But I thought I'd give it a try anyway. I wasn't having such a good time at college, so why not try this? And I was lucky. It worked out. My feet pointed and, you know, all the right things. So, you know, I was one of, you know, the fortunate few who can start late and still pull it off.
You know, I think it is the nightmare of all parents of the middle and upper class that their son or daughter will drop out of college. And, you know, drop out of college, and then you hear it's going to kill your parents if you do that. Did you hear that from your parents when you decided to drop out of Yale?
No, because my siblings, it sort of paved the way for me. I don't think one of us has graduated from college, if I recall correctly. I don't think a single one of my brothers and sisters graduated college.
Were you concerned about how it would look for your father's political career if you didn't finish at Yale?
No, no. That's a thought that rarely crosses my mind.
Yeah. So when you decided...
I don't think that he worries about, you know, how I'm going to have to explain him to my friends when he makes certain decisions. So I don't worry too much about his political career. He's done pretty well for himself.
Well, it's funny you should say that about how you were going to explain his decisions to your friends, because you were dancing with the Joffrey Ballet during a period when he was making cutbacks to the arts.
That's right. That's right. And, I went on unemployment, as a matter of fact. The whole company went on unemployment for a period of a few weeks, as the Joffrey regularly does, or did anyway in my day. And that made the headlines in New York. That was a big thing for the New York Post and that ilk.
Well, if I were you, I would have been a little self-conscious about getting on the unemployment line.
Well, hell, I paid unemployment insurance. I was a worker just like everybody else, so I figured I wasn't going to take money from my parents. That was sort of the implication of all the reporters who showed up on my doorstep one day, was that, well, why are you collecting unemployment? Why don't you just get money from your parents? I wanted to say, well, you know, some of the other dancers have wealthy parents, too. I suppose you could ask the same question of them, but you're not.
So you didn't feel at all uncomfortable about that?
No, not really.
Were the Secret Service people standing in line with you on the unemployment line?
As I recall, they waited outside.
They were
probably embarrassed.
One of those moments when it's uncomfortable, I suppose.
Yeah.
So let's get back to this thing about you having to explain your father's policies to your friends. When there were all these arts cutbacks and you were dancing in the ballet and then the whole company ends up going on unemployment, were you expected to explain your father's policies? Do your friends expect you to answer for him or to defend him or agree with him?
Well, fortunately, in the ballet world, most of my friends in the company probably weren't even aware of the cutbacks to the arts. They're a pretty apolitical bunch. Ballet being a rather claustrophobic and you know, sheltered environment. So, no, I didn't have to explain myself or my father to any of them.
Do you consider yourself apolitical?
Well, I don't know. What do you mean by apolitical?
Well, you just used the word before, but someone who's not very politically active, doesn't take a strong stand on politics, and politics isn't a primary part of their world.
Well, politics isn't a primary part of my world, and I have no intention of doing anything in politics, God knows. But that doesn't mean I don't have an opinion on a lot of things, sure.
Okay.
So I don't know where that makes me. Am I apolitical or not? I'm sort of semi-political, I guess.
Okay. You danced with the Joffrey for 2 seasons?
Yeah, well, I was with Joffrey, too, for a couple of years, and then I did a New York season, roughly a year with a big company, yeah.
Did you feel like you were in a fishbowl then, in a way or did the company feel self-conscious that they were getting a different kind of attention than they used to because of your presence in it? I don't know if that was an issue or not.
It was at times. The company probably valued the attention that they got. I never really talked to them about that too much. I felt a little uncomfortable with it because here I was a starting dancer. And I remember the first time I ever got on stage with Joffrey too, with the second company, which is sort of a small training or touring company that they have. And it was in Brooklyn at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, I think. And Clive Barnes was in the audience to review me. And that was a little strange. I mean, that's not the usual thing for Clive Barnes to come and kind of, do a review of a beginning second company dancer. So I thought that was a little strange and probably unfair.
Well, after getting started in dance as late as you did and having a really successful career early on, you left dance after a couple of seasons. Why did you want to give it up?
It didn't have anything to do with dance. I love dancing. I love performing. And I like the work. But working for a ballet company is not really quite what I expected it to be. Maybe I should have known better. But you figure that after a number of years training and becoming a professional dancer in a major company, that you and your friends, your colleagues, are entitled to a certain amount of respect, at least honesty, on the part of the company. And that wasn't always the case, and that began to bother me. And I also realized that if I had any other interests outside of dance, I wouldn't be able to explore them because dance takes up so much of your time, like all of your time.
Right.
Yeah. So that's really why I left. I asked myself if I wanted to be doing that 10 years from that point, and the answer was no.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Ron Reagan Jr., and the occasion for our interview is an upcoming Cinemax comedy experiment that he stars in. It's called Ron Reagan is the President's Son, and it debuts on January 15th. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ron Reagan is my guest. Your career as an actor, I think, got started when you guest...
A short career.
Yes, it got started when you guest-hosted Saturday Night Live.
I guess so. You could say that, yeah.
And all of us in America witnessed you in that risky business, that now famous risky business parody in which you danced in your underwear.
Uh-huh. who's... Actually, it wasn't my underwear.
Yeah,
let's clear that up.
was it stunt underwear?
Stunt underwear, yes. I had a dance belt on underneath, actually.
Whose idea was the sketch?
I think it was Al Franken's, as I recall. Al Franken and Tom Davis were there at the time, and they came up with the idea. And it was such a good idea. I mean, it was obvious that it was a good idea, that there was no discussion about it. It was just great. Let's do it.
You didn't go through the whole will I be self-conscious appearing in underwear?
No, I danced in things, that were as brief or briefer than that before in front of large audiences, so I, no.
And I've read in newspapers that you didn't call your parents first and get their reaction.
no, I guess I didn't. I don't remember when I called them or, when exactly they saw it, but...
What was their reaction?
I'm sorry. What was their reaction? They were fine about it. The risky business thing had to be explained to them because they hadn't seen the movie,
right.
So they weren't really sure why I was in my underwear in a mock-up of the Oval Office. But when it was explained to them, they appreciated the humor involved.
You know, it's interesting to me. Your father has expressed a very idealized view of the nuclear family, and he was supported by the moral majority. And in a lot of ways, you really don't seem to fit into his picture of the nuclear family. What I mean by that is, you know, on TV, you dance in your underwear. You did a series of photographs in these hot red briefs for Vanity Fair. You were living with your girlfriend before you got married. Mm-hmm. Anyways, it doesn't fit with this perfect family type of picture. And I wonder what you make of that when you hear your father painting a portrait of the family that's different from where you are.
Well, that's of course his idealized version of the family, not mine. And I've never, you know, sort of tried to pattern my life after stump speeches that my father or anybody else makes. I mean, our own family is not exactly the ideal, you know, it's not sort of the Cleavers or whatever, you know, our father knows best or anything like that. It's different, you know, it's the real world, and in the real world there aren't a lot of nuclear families that come right out of 50s sitcoms.
Do you ever feel that your father's not acknowledging the real world of your family?
How do you mean, my wife and I, or?
No, well, of you and your sister Patty and the fact that he was once divorced himself.
No, I think he, you know, he does have a somewhat idealized version, perhaps, of the world. And that might be just a generational thing. I mean, you have to remember that he was born before the First World War and grew up in sort of small-town America and things like that. And so maybe he does have a very different picture of how the world is or should be anyway. And, of course, we're, you know, from a very different generation, and we see things quite differently.
Now, a lot of people from your generation, I should say our generation, because I think we're fairly close.
I'm 29. How old are you?
Well, I'm older than you are. I'm 36, so let's see.
Well, sort of in the country. My wife is 36, so...
So we're loosely same generation. But anyways, I think a lot of young people faced with their adults with a lot of young people faced with their parents.
Yeah.
These terrible splits when the sons and daughters started either, trying marijuana or having premarital sex, living with lovers, things like that, and parents just went crazy. I mean, they got really upset and thought this was it, all their good upbringing for nothing.
Yeah, that's always been the way, though. I mean, whatever the generation was, if, you know, suddenly their kids were wearing zoot suits or whatever, and they got very upset, or listening to that awful Frank Sinatra instead of, what, Rudy Valley or something? I don't know. Well, so there's always been generational clashes like that.
But what, if anything, did your parents do to try to bring you back into the fold?
My mother still actually would prefer that I dressed a different way, I think. And she occasionally will try and tell my wife to go into my closet and throw out certain items of clothing that she doesn't particularly care for. But that's about as far as she goes.
One of the subjects that I imagine you might have some disagreements with your family now on is the subject of AIDS. I know you've been doing various educational work on behalf of AIDS education.
I did a film.
Did a film that was on public television. You've done some condom ads too, right? Well, not ads, announcements.
Public service announcements, yeah.
Yeah, recommending that people use condoms.
Right.
And find out about condoms. Have you tried to discuss the subject of AIDS with your father? People who are people from the health community and the gay community and people who are working around the subject of AIDS have been very critical of your father's policies and his lack of federal funding for AIDS programs. Yeah, so what was that like?
Well, as I said, I argue with them all the time about that sort of thing. It's not that, you know, my parents or my father specifically is unconcerned about AIDS. That wouldn't be fair. But it is fair that it's not a sort of priority item for the administration as a whole. You have to remember that the president doesn't always set the complete agenda. I mean, he's got a lot of people around him that are sort of telling him what ought to be at the top of the list and that sort of thing. I'm not trying to take away any responsibility that he has, but it's just sort of a fact. I was upset that the sort of William Bennett faction seemed to be winning out over the C. Everett Koop, faction, if you will, in the White House. I think it's an irresponsible point of view that Bennett has. I think it's an unrealistic one. And I say so. I tell my parents that, and I would tell anybody that. It's what I believe.
It sounds like you have the kind of relationship with your parents where you can disagree on issues and still be very close.
Yeah, we do all the time. I argue with them all the time. I've almost appointed myself as kind of the family heckler. I'm always fighting with them about some issue or another.
Do people who see you on TV or read you in magazines ever get a little, frustrated in a way that you're talented and funny and things like that? And here's what I mean. I think I'm not making myself clear.
So far,
just
it sounds
yet.
Very nice.
there's a lot of people who are very upset with your father because of his policies. And here you are, his son, mm-hmm. not agreeing with his policies and also, starring on Saturday Night Live, dancing in your underwear, things like that, while your father really passes judgment on life or death issues. Mm-hmm. And in a way, your presence in the entertainment world can make it seem like, well, heck, but we're all really nice, lovable, fun-loving guys. It's all just a game.
You mean fun-loving? We meaning the family, or
yeah,
or we meaning,
yeah, yeah.
Well, we are sort of fun-loving people, I suppose. But that's really not fair. I mean, should I sort of wear sackcloth and ashes and stuff in protest of various things that I disagree with? With my father. This is what I'm able to do. We all have to earn a living, and this is how I earn mine. And I don't really think I have to justify that to somebody who thinks that I should be, crusading for, an atomic free world or something.
I hope you don't mind my asking this, but
no, not at all. <Go ahead. laughs>
If Ronald Reagan wasn't your father, do you think you'd vote for him for president?
Well,
would have voted
for
him?
Well, he can't run again.
Well, so right. I'll put this in the past tense. Do you think you would have voted for him for president?
Given the choice, yeah, I probably would have. I we do disagree, and I think a lot of people who voted for him did disagree, and the reason they voted for him was that he projected a certain strength and a certain sincerity, which is true. I think that's valid, and I think I either would have voted for him or not at all. I don't think I would have voted for the alternatives.
Are you a Republican yourself?
No, I'm on the form that I filled out. There's a little space that says decline to state, and that's the one I checked.
So, what's next in your acting career?
Well, I don't know. We'll have to see how this Cinemax comedy experiment goes, and hopefully there'll be some more offers. I've had some offers, some good, some bad, some that just didn't pan out for various reasons. But I'd like to give it a try anyway and just see if I'm any good at it. And if so, you could have a lot worse life than being some sort of movie star or something.
Did you ever regret that your father entered politics and gave up show business and entertainment? Because you're really so much more tuned into the entertainment world than the political world yourself.
No, I never really thought about that. I mean, that's his life. Everybody's got to do what they want to do with their own lives.
But your life was directly affected. You had to live in the governor's mansion instead of in the, in the heart of the filmmaking industry.
Yeah, they were never very much a Hollywood family, or we were never much of a Hollywood family. It wasn't like a lot of movie stars were running in and out of our house. So I never felt like I was really that much of a part of that world.
Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank you very much for spending some of your time with us.
Well, thank you.
My guest has been Ron Reagan, and he stars in a Cinemax comedy experiment that will debut on January 15th. And as you probably know, he can also be seen as a special correspondent on Good Morning America and is a contributing editor at Playboy magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Andrew Porter. He's the classical music critic for The New Yorker magazine, and he's just published a collection of his articles in a new book titled Musical Events. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with Chicago-based composer, arranger, and saxophonist Edward Wilkerson. His 25-piece band Shadow Vignettes released the critically acclaimed album Birth of a Notion. Wilkerson's other band, the octet Eight Bold Souls, has just released a new album. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Letters from Mississippi, the new album from Eddie Hinton. He's the former lead guitarist for the Muscle Shoals rhythm section, and he's played with musicians as diverse as Elvis Presley, Boss Gags, and Herbie Mann. And film critic Stephen Schiff looks at the most popular movie in America today, Three Men and a Baby. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. The United Nations Security Council has called upon Israel to return the four Palestinians it deported from the occupied territories this week. The resolution had no opponents, but the United States abstained. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The Security Council vote was 14-0 in favor of pressing Israel to rescind the deportations and to refrain from deporting any more Palestinians. Today's vote followed an earlier Security Council decision on January 5th calling upon Israel before the fact not to undertake the deportations. The United States voted in favor of that resolution. Today, Ambassador Vernon Walters said the U.S. does not approve of the deportations, but he also criticized the Council for selectively considering this issue.
We believe that repeatedly raising the issue in the Security Council does not assist the process of restoring calm to the territories.
UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar also criticized the deportations. Israeli representatives say they will ignore the UN's pleas. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
Today, Israel handed over the four deported Palestinians to a Syrian-backed guerrilla group in Lebanon. The four said they would start a hunger strike. On the occupied West Bank today, Israeli troops shot and killed another Palestinian. At least 34 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli troops since the violence began. Robert Bork, President Reagan's defeated Supreme Court nominee, resigned today from the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Bork said that he wanted to speak, write, and teach about the law more freely than is possible while on the bench. President Reagan accepted Bork's resignation, saying he did so with deep sadness. Two freight trains collided today and caught fire near Thompsontown, Pennsylvania. Two people were killed. Two others were injured. One of the trains was carrying coal, the other tractor trailers. Conrail spokeswoman Kathleen Burns said officials think the coal train was at fault.
The cause is under investigation. However, I understand this is a double-track railroad equipped with a modern traffic control signal system. The signals were set for the coal train to stop at a control point just west of Thompsontown to allow the intermodal train to cross to the other track. Preliminary indications are that the coal train did not stop at the control point.
Conrail spokeswoman Kathleen Byrne. Former Charleston, West Virginia Mayor Mike Rourke was sentenced today in federal court. Last November, he pleaded guilty to 6 counts of cocaine possession. Details from Vance Heiner of West Virginia Public Radio.
U.S. District Judge Walter Hoffman sentenced Rourke before a packed courtroom this morning to 179 days in a minimum security prison with no eligibility for parole. Hoffman also fined Rourke $5,000 for 2 counts of cocaine possession and placed him on 3 years probation for the remaining 4 counts. Rourke had faced up to 6 years in prison and $30,000 in fines. As a former county prosecutor and mayor of West Virginia's largest city, Rourke was nicknamed Mad Dog for his vigorous prosecution of drug dealers. Although Rourke had no comment following sentencing, federal prosecutor Joe Savage said he was pleased with the judge's decision.
Mike Rourke started out by saying it didn't happen, and that was a lie. Then they took the position that it wasn't serious, and the judge has shown today that that was wrong as well.
Rourke must begin serving his sentence at a federal prison camp by February 15th. For National Public Radio, I'm Vance Heiner in Charleston, West Virginia.
Retail sales rose 0.7% last month. New car sales for the month were up nearly 2.5%. Excluding autos, sales for December rose just 0.2%. Sales of all items at the retail level were up $900 million over the month before. And stock prices were mixed at the close of trading on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was off more than 8 points at 1961.11. This is National Public Radio News. I'm Mara Liasson in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Letters from Mississippi, a new album from Eddie Hinton. Hinton was born in Jacksonville, Florida, grew up in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He sang in church, and one of his early instrumental experiences was in the University of Alabama Drum and Bugle Corps.
Almost 10 years ago, Eddie Hinton put out an album called Very Extremely Dangerous that sounded like the best Otis Redding ripoff I'd ever heard, the debut of a soul singer with real nerve and promise. I reviewed the record that way, and so did a lot of other critics, and we were all subsequently surprised to find out that Eddie Hinton was a white singer who'd been playing guitar behind rhythm and blues acts for two decades. He'd also written songs recorded by everyone from Aretha Franklin to the Box Tops. This new Eddie Hinton record, Letters from Mississippi, is his first album since Very Extremely Dangerous, and it's very extremely good. Eddie Hinton's Letters from Mississippi is a throwback to an earlier time, to the 60s, when a Southern rocker like Hinton would take for granted a combination of rock, soul, and rhythm and blues. I wasn't the only person who heard Otis Redding in his voice. It's been reported that Redding's widow hired Hinton to give Otis's sons singing lessons. You can pick out other influences in Eddie Hinton's singing and guitar playing, the sounds of people as disparate as Van Morrison, Al Green, and John Fogerty. At the same time, Letters from Mississippi isn't a nostalgia record. Its music has a timeless quality that makes it sound just right for 1988.
Sorry that I lied. Yes, I'm sorry.
past 10 years haven't been easy ones for Hinton. The producer of this new album, John D. Weicker, was a Hinton fan who found his hero living on the street outside the Salvation Army in Decatur, Alabama a few years ago. I think it's amazing that when Weicker arranged to get Hinton recording again, Hinton came prepared with material as strong as this. This is the point in the review where I'm supposed to complain about how stupid and conservative rock radio is, how if only people heard Eddie Hinton's music, they'd buy it in droves. But I'm not sure that's true. Hinton is very much a product of his time. But I do think that if people supporting new records by older performers like Robbie Robertson, George Harrison, and Van Morrison got a chance to listen to Letters from Mississippi, they'd like it a lot, especially the poignant moment at the start of the album's title song, when Hinton croaks, "Always told you I'd be coming back in a Cadillac." Here's hoping Eddie Hinton gets his Cadillac.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Eddie Hinton's album, Letters from Mississippi, is available from Mighty Field of Vision Records, Drawer A, Decatur, Alabama, 35602.
Always told you I'd be coming back in a Cadillac. More money than anybody else in town. Oh, baby, love you like no other, but I still can't get no better than sitting around, rocking the blues.
This is Fresh Air. Edward Wilkerson is a Chicago-based jazz composer and saxophonist who is not yet a household name, even in the jazz world. But his records have made it onto 10 best lists in Newsweek, USA Today, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. His music, he describes as modern music that retains the pageantry, color, and humor of a night at the Cotton Club of Harlem in the 30s. He leads a 25-piece big band called Shadow Vignettes, and a scaled-down version, an octet called Eight Bold Souls. The octet has a new album. Edward Wilkerson studied music at the University of Chicago and the AACM School of Music. It was the AACM Musicians Cooperative that introduced him to the sound of a modern big band.
One of the most fantastic experiences was coming to Chicago and hearing the AACM big band, and that group it just wiped me out. They used to play every Monday night at a place called Transitions East on the south side of Chicago. And I listened to the band a lot, and then after a while I played in the reed section, and it was quite an experience for me.
How did you organize your first big band? I'm wondering in part how you found so many really good musicians to bring together.
Well, originally Shadow Vignettes, believe it or not, started out as a trio. It was myself, Yosef Ben-Israel on bass, and Reggie Nicholson on drums. And we would perform, and people would come up and they'd say they'd like to play with the group. So it became a five-piece group, and then we did some things with nine pieces, 11, and then I went ahead with a full big band instrumentation. And then about a year before we did the album, we added some pieces that included strings. And we kind of grew to 25 members, but I've made a promise that we will not get any larger than that because it becomes kind of unmanageable. So right now we're kind of sticking with 25 members, and we're touring with that size group now.
We'll be right back. You've performed in a lot of really different settings. You've performed with a lot of jazz musicians, a lot of jazz avant-gardists. When you were coming of age, you performed with Joseph Jarman and Roscoe Mitchell. You also, though, performed in a lot of rhythm and blues groups and soul groups with Little Anthony and the Imperials, Albert King, the Drifters.
Yeah.
Did you see that as a way to make money, or were you really into it?
Oh, both. I mean, it was money, but I was very honored to do many of those concerts. Playing with Little Anthony, I mean, to be on stage and to hear some of those songs, it really gave me goosebumps. And to meet him, his name is Anthony Gourdin, and he spoke of one of the most important times musically for him was when he went to hear Coltrane play saxophone and the influence that he had on his singing. And that's, he's very well versed musically. I mean, he listens to everything. And I had a chance to travel with Gene Chandler, he was, you know, the Duke of Earl. And these are, you know, these are songs I grew up with, and to be on stage with giants like this, it's, I enjoyed it. I thought it was fabulous. I mean, it wasn't a lot of money, but the money was part of it, though. But the main thing was to be in contact with musicians like this, and it helped to add to some of the vocabulary that I think is kind of at my disposal.
What kinds of things musically do you think you picked up?
Well, it's a lot of, there's a certain immediacy in traveling on the road in that type of circuit, what some people might call the Chitlin circuit or whatever, but there's an immediacy in the music and there's a need to make contact with people in that music. And I would always like to have that in what I do. I try to maintain that in what I do. And also, I mean, working with like Albert King, we would play a concert till like 2 or 3 in the morning, and then he would hop in the bus and drive all night to the next concert. And to see people like that with that kind of commitment is, you don't find it in too many other types of music now. And to see how they lead a band and to how they work with their sidemen, how they organize their tours. And it's a learning, it was a real learning process for me, not just about the music, but in how to make music a part of your life and how to make your life music. And for me, it was very important to be with people like this. And I'll do it again, you know, if the opportunity is right, I will go out again like that, because it's a very valuable experience.
Are there things that you learned from being on the road with these musicians that you applied to taking your own band on the road? Things to look out for?
Yeah. I think with, especially with Shadow Vignettes, since it's such a large group, I'm very conscious of having the correct chemistry with the group. And I think you don't want to have a group that's all of the same type of person, because you need a certain chemical reaction to happen on stage, and you can't get it if everyone's the same. You need some people who have certain qualities of stability in their musicianship, and then you need a few people on stage who each night you never know what they're going to do. I mean, there's that certain unpredictable something that makes things happen, and they instigate things on stage in a musical sense. And you need some of those people in the group, and you need a good, you know, a good melange of people in order to make a certain reaction happen. And I've been very conscious of how musicians put these groups together, and I think most of the better group leaders are very conscious of the chemistry of musicians, and you'll find that they'll include a large dichotomy of people, of musician in their groups. And I've tried to maintain that in Shadow Vignettes and in Eight Bowl Souls.
You know, on your first album, on your big band album, you didn't perform. You composed all the music and you led the band, but you didn't play on it. On your new album, the old Eight Bold Souls album, you do perform. What's behind that switch? How come you didn't perform on the first one and you do perform now?
Well, with Shadow Vignettes, I initially felt more comfortable on stage just trying to direct the band and keep track of things. Now when we perform, I do play a little bit. But there's so many good soloists in the band, and I felt kind of funny getting up there and taking a lot of solos and everything. Now I feel a little more comfortable, and I feel that the music, the conception of the band is a little more solid, where I feel like I can turn my back on these guys.
in a lot of ways, New York is really the place to get recognition.
Mm-hmm.
What keeps you in Chicago? Do you plan on staying there?
I think I've made a certain commitment to Chicago, and I'd like to stay here. I like the city. I'm from Cleveland originally, which is kind of similar, but it's a little smaller than Chicago. I think being here offers a lot of opportunities for me. I like New York. I like to visit, but I think it's a little too fast-paced for me. I get a little too nervous there. And Los Angeles is a little too easygoing. So Chicago offers the best of both worlds. So I'm going to stay here. I think you'll see in the next few years that there'll be a decentralization of, I think, the artistic community in the sense that people might not have to go to New York to be successful artistically. I think it used to be like that where I always tell about I used to be able to tell where a tenor saxophonist came from by the way he played. And that was during the 30s and 40s and 50s. But now, in the last 20 years or so, you can't make that distinction necessarily. But I think we'll return to a time when there'll be regional bands and people will be able to stay in their cities, make contributions, and still have an impact nationally and internationally.
Jazz composer and saxophonist Ed Wilkerson. His new album, Eight Bold Souls, is on Sesame Records. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Jerry.
What story is he following?
We have a report on the Alexander Haig campaign. Former Secretary of State, former Chief of Staff in the Nixon White House, is pursuing the Republican nomination. And we have a report on, it's not going all that well, but he certainly is still trying. Also, on the stump with Senator Paul Simon of Illinois, one of the Democratic hopefuls. Linda Wertheimer reports to us what a Simon campaign speech is like. Also, today we have a report from a Palestinian refugee camp in the occupied territories. And also, we hear from an Israeli military spokesman who happens to be here in the States defending their treatment of the riots.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The number one movie in the country right now is Three Men and a Baby. It's a remake of a 1985 French film, possibly the fastest movie remake in history. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has these thoughts on what the fuss is all about.
I dragged my feet about seeing it. The French version, Three Men and a Cradle, had been bad enough, even though it was a monster hit in France. And now there was this American remake starring, in descending order, Tom Selleck, Ted Danson, and gruesome Steve Guttenberg. It all seemed too awful to bear. But Three Men and a Baby has turned out to be a phenomenon. Not only was it the number one hit of the Christmas season, it was also the fourth biggest box office hit of 1987. And seeing it proved revelatory. Not because the movie's any good, it's almost unbelievably terrible, but because it helped me understand what the recent baby boom at the movies is all about. The plot has our three bachelor heroes living in their bachelor pad in New York City. The Danson character has gone off to Turkey to act in a film. And one day his roommates, a successful architect and a successful cartoonist, find a baby on their doorstep. Sound cute? Cute ain't the half of it.
What's going on? I don't know what's going on. Oh, okay. Just look out in the hall. Yeah? Just look out in the hall. Okay. That's a baby.
Oh, I know, it's a baby. What's it doing there?
It's sleeping.
The women in the audience I saw the movie with seemed to love watching these big, strong hunkos go all helpless changing diapers. But that's hardly the sole source of its appeal. What's interesting about this and the other 1987 baby movies, Baby Boom and Raising Arizona, is that they're not about real-life parenting. They're not about getting pregnant and giving birth and raising a child. No, in these movies, babies come from the blue, as though the stork really were to blame. And then we get a whole lot of jokes about the mysteries of diapers and bottles and formula, and what happens when the baby cries in the middle of the night. Well, what really is going on here? The thing that clarified it all for me was seeing the apartment the bachelors and Three Men and a Baby live in. It's a hilariously huge, chic, yuppified mini-palace in a grand building on Central Park West. A great place for the classy parties these guys give. A great place to bring women and show off your stereo and your CD and your video equipment and your remote controls and your cordless phones and your computer and your Cuisinarts and your baby. Ah, that's it. In the Baby Boom movies, a child becomes just another yuppie gadget. Something that, like any digital stereophonic remote-operated gizmo, is hard to figure out at first. But hey, no problem. That's what the owner's manual is for. You know, the one by Dr. Spock. And once you learn how to use your new plaything, you naturally develop a certain affection for it. Three Men and a Baby is like a glossy ad for daddyhood. Get one of these, and when you break it in, you'll find you can't live without it. Of course, the movie has other aspects. There's a tiresome subplot about drug dealers and cops and detectives. There's some of the worst acting ever done, even by these three excruciating actors. There's a soundtrack that sounds like 50 sitcom opening themes strung together. But these things aren't what make Three Men and a Baby a hit. It's a hit because it reassures its yuppie audience about a process that could otherwise seem dark and awesome. Don't worry, its TV-style pitchmen proclaim, this isn't one of life's big mysteries. Having a baby is something you already know how to do. Think of it as simply a higher form of shopping.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Greg Ford and Terry Lennon, the co-writers and co-directors of The Duxorcist. It's the first Daffy Duck cartoon to be made for theaters in 20 years, and it comes on the 50th anniversary of Warner Brothers' Looney Tunes. Country and blues guitarist Moses Rasko will be back to sing some more songs, and critic at large Laurie Stone will discuss the sexual politics of the new hit movie Broadcast News. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.